2, 3, 4.
I think a good teacher is someone that comes to school not for the fact that they're getting paid and they come to school for the student.
It's a boy thing.
What I think makes a good teacher is a teacher that's willing to connect with their students, make an effort to get to know their students.
It's a boy thing.
Like when the teacher's approachable and you don't feel intimidated when you go up to talk to them.
It's a boy thing.
Bags, we're back in the room.
Hi, we are back in the room. That is us. What, at our last podcast episode for this year, right?
That's right. This is the winding up phase of the year. We've just finished marking all our year 11 examinations, which has been such a fascinating experience. We gave them all level 2 exams just to see how they'd go.
And?
They would actually do very well if they were sitting NCEA level 2, which is a really good thing. But we're assessing it using our year 11 assessment tool, which includes quite a significant literacy assessment component. And you know, I was saying to my class today, their year 11 students, their essays are actually brilliant in many ways, but their literacy is still not there. And I just said, you've been at school for 11 years and honestly we've still got work to do. Your accuracy is not there. Like stage 4 in our little scheme says perfect accuracy. It means you'll write an essay in an exam and you won't make any errors barring perhaps the odd typo. And there's only, I would say, about 1/3 who have reached that stage in their writing where they can just write without making errors.
Can I say, though, that that's still pretty good, 1/3? Anyway, I know that they've still got work to do, but 1/3's pretty good, yeah.
So we've got 1/3 there, and that is, I mean, that's an achievement for them and us, but we've got, and we've got 1/3 who are kind of passable and whose errors would all have been picked up by the spell checker if they had one, you know, so they would have ended up producing something perfect with a spell checker. And then we've got 1/3 that are still in deep need of structured and deliberate teaching of writing mechanics. Like they literally still need it. When we'll obviously next year keep teaching it until they are able to do these things independently. It's a really interesting, sobering, positive thing. Year 11 students can handle level 2 questions because, of course, we don't do level 1 NCEA. And so that's been good to see.
I think it's important to ask, you're talking about you'll continue to teach it in level 2. So in year 12, you'll do explicit teaching of writing still?
Oh, very much so. In fact, we do it within the context of the writing portfolio, but we are doing writing mechanics as much as we are doing form and structure and, and style in relation to writing. And so we just, I mean, I guess it's that thing about being committed to making them literate, is that it doesn't stop until they are.
Yeah, okay. Then I think that's good because I guess my thoughts around it would be that a lot of people would think that you possibly would only do that with junior students and then, oh, that'll be fine when they get to the senior school. We don't really, you know, they'll know how to do this stuff. And, of course, the reality is that they don't. They don't.
No,
so it's, again, that constant working, that constant explicit teaching and knowing that we can't just stop. Again, it's coming back to what we were talking about with our AI episode. If you want to be good at something, you continue to practice it. If you stop practicing it, then you lose the skills. So,
exactly right. And the other thing, of course, that I find wonderful about teaching, you know, writing mechanics to senior students is that they're cognitively more mature. They learn faster. You can take it at a faster pace and be a little bit more complex in your approach to it because they can actually pay attention and keep paying attention. So if you're practicing skills, more advanced sentence formulations or one of or any of those things, that they're actually better at learning by that stage as long as you've made the case that it's a valuable thing to learn. They're there. And so you don't have to spend as much time at it, actually.
Yeah, that's cool. No, I like that. I didn't teach year 12 this year, but I historically would teach year 12. And, of course, since teaching year 12 the last time, well, I did teach it last year at Queen's, but it was a different sort of course. But I've really obviously immersed myself in the Grammar for Writing program since, I guess, and so I would be doing things differently. And so it's nice. It's just nice to have this reinforcement of the practice that you're doing and making sure that, of course, that if we're committed to changing literacy results, not only for the boys that are immediately in front of us, but for boys across the country, and this is an appeal to our colleagues that are listening, we have to do the work. We have to keep doing it. We can't quit.
I'm just thinking about what might underpin the question, do you continue teaching literacy to year 12 students? And I was thinking, of course, in the system, they'll have all passed their NCEA literacy co-requisites by that point. And so perhaps some schools might think, okay, job done on literacy, but those literacy co-requisite standards are actually quite low.
High level four, right? That's what they are, level 4A.
And that's halfway through the curriculum. So, yes, it's very important that we ensure all students reach that level of literacy, but it is not the end.
Mm-mm.
I think we were just mentioning previous to hitting record that at our school, we don't let the students even use a spell checker when they're writing up to the end of year 11 because we have that control. So one of the things that the classes will have next year in year 12 is access to those writing tools when they do their assessments. And that does mask their lack of literacy to some extent. And so it can lead to you thinking you don't have to keep teaching it because the work that they're handing in looks good.
It's amazing, isn't it, though, all those things that you can know yourself and then you can pass on to your students that just makes them better. I'm sitting looking at my whiteboard. This is slightly on a tangent, but, you know, we've been doing a poem at the moment, my year nine boys and I, and talking to them about how many letters in the English alphabet, 26, okay, and how many sounds are there? What are sounds? 43. So some of them have done structured literacy, but most of them haven't, because we were looking at assonance, and I was trying to get them to understand repetition of vowel sounds, not letters. And so, again, getting them to understand all these things. And I did this with my year 11s earlier in the year. So for them, they were kind of like, what? Mind blown. There's 43 sounds. Yeah, there's 43 sounds. So, you know, what does that mean for us? How does that help us when we're unpacking things, whether that's doing an unfamiliar text analysis or whether that's actually getting them to be better spellers or whatever it is? They have to have these tools to make them more proficient in their literacy.
Yeah. So should we pivot to that? Because our thoughts about today were, after talking about AI last week and essentially, you know, speaking about it as something that shouldn't enter the ordinary life of an English classroom, we thought we'd talk about some of the things that we think definitely should be part of the ordinary life of an English classroom by exemplification, just by providing a couple of very specific and concrete examples of what actually happens in our classes, at least. Are you up for that?
Yeah, I would love to do it. Love to do it. So my year nines, well, our junior boys have obviously just finished their school exams. Fabulous exam, by the way. It sounds really arrogant, but actually really proud of the exam that was created for our students, really robust, and gave them the chance to really showcase their wares and obviously for us as teachers to assess their gaps and the things that they excel in as well. My year nine boys need to work on their analysis of unfamiliar text. So in some of the moments in their exam, and I think this is important to then understand what I'm going to talk about as an example from my class, they would be able to possibly identify a language feature in a piece of poetry or in the unfamiliar text, but then they struggle to identify the effect of that. Now, we've been doing work on this all year. As a reflective practitioner, I've gone, maybe I could have been even more explicit in my teaching of this, and I will make sure that I adapt my program further next year, I think, because of it. But certainly they would do things like, if we use an example from the Stephen Adams biographical piece, because that sort of dovetailed nicely into the biography work that we've been doing. He worked the room like a politician. So after the boys got their exams back, I wrote that up on the board. And they were able to say it's a simile. Cool. So it uses like or as. What then is the effect of this? And they might say, oh, he's powerful. These were some of the things. He's powerful. He's charming. Great. Then one student said, it compared Stephen Adams to something we already knew. And I went, okay. And I said, I'm sorry, I'm going to make an example of you with this. And I got my pen and I circled round his thing of comparing something to we already know. And I said, what have you done with this? And he said, I haven't told you anything. And I said, correct. You haven't told me anything. That's just restating what I already know. You haven't unpacked it. And that was kind of an, light bulb moment for that boy, but for a lot of boys in the class who in their unfamiliar text analysis may have given definitions, or they didn't go to that place of really talking about, well, if he's like a politician, that means that he's charming, he's possibly manipulative, he might be, you know, Cheshire Cat vibe, whatever it is, okay? And it was just simply a restating of things that they already knew. So then what I've done is that I've presented them with one of your favourites, Chris, The Magpies by Dennis Glover. Such a beautiful New Zealand poem. And I read through that with them yesterday. We're actually going to go through the exam, but I've got students who are still doing biographical work, so it's kind of staggered at the moment. Read the magpie poem to them. And I got them just to do a really simple exercise with me, and I'm still looking at what's left on my whiteboard, of, okay, what are the things that we actually notice here? Before we even go into the idea of euphemism or maybe the assonance or the onomatopoeia or whatever. And so they were able to pick up on really nice things, like, of course, the repetition or the contrast. They actually did get the contrast, which was really cool. And then they were able to start seeing things like I would give them really leading questions. What do you notice about the punctuation? Oh, there's a full stop down there. Okay, why is it only there? What is the point of only having a full stop there? What do you notice about the use of capital letters? Oh, it falls at the beginning of each stanza, but also for the magpies lowercase. Okay, why do you think it's got a capital T there? What is the importance of giving the at last line of that stanza the capitalization? Once we did that and we broke down each stanza, what it moved through, what happened with time, then they were able to start then unpacking the intention of the piece, to talk about the comparison between humans and nature and possibly the cycle of nature. And some of my kids were saying amazing things like, actually, it's really childlike. One of my wee boys said, it's really childlike with the kind of sing-songy vibe of the magpies, but it's got really dark themes in it. And so they were able to unpack these features simply by my reading of the poem and what do you see? Just the first thing was, my first question to them was, what do you visually see with this piece? And it was incredible, the amount of writing that I put up on the board for the things that they actually said. So that's kind of something that we're doing. I've given them set questions with that poem that now, because I've worked on it with them and I've said, right, this is what a euphemism is, this is what this is, you know, now I want you to actually really go in depth and actually really break down, go further than you think you have to on what was being achieved in relation to the questions that I've posed to you. And so that's a specific example of unpacking a piece of unfamiliar text with my boys, paying attention to, in this moment, I guess, more than anything, what they visually saw, the effects of what they visually saw, before they then go further in depth at looking at the language features and the effect to be able to unpack the author's intention.
There's an additional thought, a pedagogy there embedded, kind of driven by Piaget, which is that notion of social construction, where by asking open-ended questions and responding to the answers neutrally and supporting the students to start discussing their ideas, there's a lot of learning going on for them through the formulation and articulation of their thoughts in response to a text. So it's the boys actually saying it in the classroom context that is assisting the learning. And the second thing is obviously modeling, like demonstrating the thing you're asking for over and over again in conjunction with their work and ideas, so that they're actually understanding what it looks like to do the thing you're asking for. It's pretty great.
And I think it was a moment of it being quite empowering for them, because they probably looked at a piece of poetry as, maybe I can make an assumption about boys. Apologies, boys, but, you know, oh, I didn't realize I have to get all emotional, or I have to, I can't understand poems, I don't know what they're talking about. Actually, no, you can. And I, the thing about it was that I presented the poem to about five of them on Tuesday, because there was more members of the class doing the biographical writing, and I said, have a go at it. And I didn't do any of that unpacking with them. And the unpacking, of course, is asking, as you have identified, the open-ended questions. I didn't give them things. You know, I don't give them things when I'm teaching. They've got to have the learning moment, because if I give them, if I give them everything, if I spoon feed them, then they're not going to harness or take hold of the learning or have that moment of realization. So I don't do that. You know how I roll, Chris. So, but it was really fascinating watching them on the Tuesday, those four, a lot of them, because I sit at the back of the room to keep an eye on their screens to make sure they're on task. And a lot of them were sitting there just kind of, and I know you're watching me now, but it was hidden hand. Like kind of like, bloody hell, what has she just given us? So I read the room on the Tuesday and it was like, mate, what is this? Oh my God. But then when we did it yesterday, it was like, don't know why I overcomplicated this. This is not that hard at all. All I need to do to start is actually just look at it. Just look at the visual things that I see to start off. And then, okay, ask myself some questions around what does this mean if this is used a few times? What is the effect of this rather than it's just too hard, I give up?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, because poems are inherently not concrete, it's,
yes.
You know, that level of cognitive abstraction is just hard. It's genuinely hard. And managing the ambiguity of poetry is a genuinely challenging thing to do. So our work is not so much to explain the poem for them, but simply to help them with these really organized analytical procedures that they can follow in order to come to understanding. And that's obviously sits upon quite a lot of concrete preparation in terms of knowing what language features are. And, you know, there's a whole lot that sits behind being able to do that successfully, I think. Sounds excellent. I mean, it is the core of English teaching, you know, close reading in that way. It's a massive part of what we all do in the classroom. And it's happening across the country all the time, I dare say. And I think that that's fantastic. I mean, that's where I think things are very good and very healthy.
Well, I also think the thing about it is that it's a really nice process, not only for me, I enjoy it. Like, I love it. I love being able to gift my students this moment where they can, again, as they always do in my classroom, own the learning. But also, I find it really stimulating. I find it stimulating being able to ask the correct questions that are open-ended questions to get them thinking and then seeing the reward that they have when they realize they can do it. Like I was just kind of a small, I mean, you'd say I'm a small part in that. I'm not, I am, but I'm not. Do you know what I mean? I will be a big part until then they go, I can actually do this myself. And I didn't need that to happen. But really nice learning. And again, I'm just feeling quite happy with the things that they've said. Life is constant. Humans are more complicated but inferior to nature. This is the stuff that they've said. And I've written up on the board, life is fast. A full stop signifying the end of their journey. It stops the rhythm of life. This is what my year nine boy said. Don't tell me that year nine boys can't be brilliant. They can.
Yeah, they totally can. And they need a lot of encouragement and coaching, but they certainly can come up with some amazing things, can't they? Mm. I mean, our boys do actually read and write quite a lot of poetry these days because they're doing so many different forms of writing. Poetry's become quite present. And so even in the NCEA program, they're writing poetry for writing portfolio and things like that.
That's awesome.
Kind of cool. And they do get into it. Like they like poetry.
Well, I think that's a good way, though, to if you keep exposing them to it and then you're asking them to do it as well, it means that you're taking away that moment of it being difficult.
If it's foreign, it's going to be intimidating, isn't it? If the first time they encounter a poem is in their exam at the end of the year, then of course it's going to be intimidating. I thought I'd share a writing thing, and I'm going to try and stay as kind of narrow and specific as possible. So in one of our programs where we engage in the genre of satire, we obviously try and get the boys to write satirical material. And there are lots of mechanisms for satire. So there's a lot of form that supports the satirical outcomes. And one of the things we interrogate in order to help them write better satirical material is the sentence form aspect. So one of the underlying mechanisms of satire that drives this is the punchline. The idea that humor is often driven by a joke form, and the joke form is often leading you along a path and then pulling the carpet out with a punchline, and that's actually reflected in sentence mechanics. And so it can either be done by an extended complex sentence followed by a simple sentence that has the punchline, or even more, a complex compound sentence where the final clause is the punchline. And both of those things we discovered when we interrogated the likes of Clive James is literally how they write. They're using the language structure to reinforce the humor. And the humor is, it's periodic, I think the term is, where the kind of humor part is suspended until the end and it's delayed. And the more the delay, the more funny it becomes at the end. And so we are then essentially deconstruct humorous pieces by looking at the sentence structure of that piece of humor. And then once they've understood that it's a complex compound sentence with a concluding subordinate clause that contains the incongruous humor, we get them to make up jokes and write them in that exact same sentence form so that they to see if it improves the joke. And largely it does. Like, their jokes are funnier when they structure them using this sentence formulation. And so, you know, we might be working with a year 13 class here where by then they actually do know the difference between a simple compound and complex sentence. But this is about applying it for purpose. Like, it's an effective use of sentence structure for intentional purpose, as opposed to just doing it because the teacher's telling you to vary your sentence lengths. And the other thing, of course, when you're working with boys in particular, that sense of mischief emerges and the competition to make the funniest joke in the sentence structure becomes quite strong. And so they're trying to outdo each other and their sentences become longer and longer and more convoluted to the point of absurdity and to the point where they're not effective anymore as well. But it's a great exploration where you're using a sentence mechanics focus, but you're also teaching humor and how the mechanisms of language support the mechanisms of humor. And that in itself, I think, is a really brilliant way of bringing meaning to that mechanical learning, and it goes off so beautifully. And then we typically get them to ultimately produce pieces of writing, like, I don't know if you came across those Shit Town series that were on Facebook and they ended up publishing them. So they write Shit Towns pieces about places they know, and they are really meaningfully funny because within those pieces there's about 7 or 8 different satirical methods that are able to be taught at a language level. And so you just teach the methodology and then they reconstruct the writing and they are funny. It's just great because they do bring that point of view that I think is part of the magic of teaching boys.
I mean, you've always been a fan of satire, and I love hearing this, by the way, but I'm sitting here listening thinking I admire the boys because I just don't even think I could be funny in that way. I'd feel with so much pressure, but look at them. They rise to the challenge, don't they?
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because you're right. I mean, we are there is jeopardy in a lot of the things we're asking our boys to do. Like, they are having to take either emotional risks or they're having to test their skills, or they're having, or there's an element of competition, and I know we actually have to manage that. Like, it's not – It's a driver for boys, and it's can be very positive in terms of fueling motivation. But you're right to raise the downside of that, which is the risk of failure and the effect of embarrassment or the kind of social outcomes for that. And I think in a classroom, you've really got to. I mean, honestly, we just seem to say the same thing every time we talk. The relationship has to be there, doesn't it? Like, it has to first be a safe environment before you can take risks like that.
Yeah, no, I think that's fabulous. I mean, and this is just, again, a reinforcement to people that they can actually have a go at doing these things themselves. Like, you love the satire, so therefore you feel comfortable with it and the language features within it. But also you do have an incredible skill set where you're actually able to know and identify different types of structures or devices that sit within an probably all text types and how they're used, but particularly your satire, because again, you're fond of it. But I think it's that reinforcement to our colleagues or people listening that actually you can have a go at this and not to be afraid. Sometimes it does take hard work because you have to be prepared in advance, but there will, by knowing what the features are and being able to talk to them, but also part of what comes through doing this, whether you have the artist model, then you unpack it and then you apply the features to the student's writing or they apply them. But you also will find that sitting possibly in the uncomfortable space of knowing that you're all learning together is quite a liberating moment as well.
Yeah.
You know, like they'll see things sometimes that you were completely unaware of, or they might have a different lens or take on it. And that's quite a magical thing as well, I find.
It totally is. And because we're actually operating in that exploratory way, it happens all the time. And so, you know, we're bringing all of this really formal knowledge to what otherwise is a very open-ended, very expeditional way of teaching. And I think, you know, both of those things in parity are wonderful. And I think that's why there's so much life in the classroom, why the students are so engaged with it, why they're so avidly attached to it.
It's just, again, that reinforcement as well, that the relationships in a classroom are key. And I know you said, God, every time we talk, we say the same thing. But also that in order to be an effective practitioner, we have to role model. We have to role model our vulnerabilities. We have to role model being open to learning and experiencing things. And it's cool. Like, I know that we're talking about things that we actually do, specific things that we do, but it's opened up a whole raft of actually pedagogical approaches and lots of things that come with it, and that's epic. Loved it.
Yeah. Well, we're moving into last phases. It's activities, prize givings, all sorts of stuff on our agenda, and carols on the quad, all sorts of stuff going on for our end of year wind up. How about you?
Yeah, we've got junior prize giving to come. We've got a year 8 barbecue for the new families coming in. That's tomorrow's Friday, isn't it? Where the week's going. And then, yeah, just tidying things up. There's lots of boys out doing sports things. But you know the nice thing about here, we do have year 10s off at camp, but I am really liking that our year 9s are actually here at school, because usually, obviously, at the end of the year for a lot of schools, year 9s are off doing things. But I'm still teaching my boys and I'm really liking it. I'm really enjoying just being here, unpacking the magpie's pond. But actually, we're going to go back through their exams and I'm going to get them to attempt the exams again. God, they'll be loving being in class with me.
Bagley. That's such a Bagley move.
There's no movies.
We're going to do the exam again.
Yeah, we're doing the exam. You'll love me. You'll thank me for it later. No, but no one's coming and going, oh, Miss, can we watch movies? They know not to ask me that question. But that's the sort of thing that we're happening. I do want to share on another note that actually my year 10 drama class, they're doing their final and first live performance next Friday. I've invited teachers with non-contacts and parents and whānau to come in, and goodness knows what's going to come from that, but that feels quite exciting and daunting, but wonderful. So I'm just, you know, rolling with the punches at this point in the year anyway.
We won't be recording again until 2025, and it'll be probably week 2 of the school year before people hear from us.
Yeah, so please do come back. Don't forget about us, and we won't forget about you guys, but, you know, we are going to take a break because, let's face it, do we want to talk about teaching on the holidays? Chris and I still will text about teaching in the holidays, but, you know, everyone deserves a break, so we're going to take a break just like people can take a break from listening to us, but, you know.
Yep, exactly. Or they can go through the back catalogue if they just discovered us. We wish everyone a great summer, or if you're in the Northern Hemisphere, a good winter.
Yeah, I agree. And, take care of everyone in the festive season and enjoy the time that you have, whether that's time with family or friends or just by yourself reading a blimmin' good book.
It's a Boy Thing, a fortnightly chat about teaching English to boys with Gina and Chris.
It's when the teacher doesn't treat the students like their students, like they treat them like they're kind of like colleagues.
I think what makes a good teacher is clear set deadlines, good communication, willingness to go over topics that some of us might find confusing,